Today at Reader's Corner, Candace Millard, author of Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and The Making of Winston Churchill. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Throughout history, brave souls have answered the call to serve their countries and to risk it all on the battlefield. But few have done it with more guts and gusto than Winston Churchill. In her latest book, Hero of the Empire, Candace Millard introduces us to a young Churchill who believed early on that he was destined to lead and who thirsted for a chance to be a war hero, mostly so he could be recognized for it. During the Boer War of 1899, in which the British Empire drove into South Africa, he got his chance. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Candace Millard. She is a former writer and editor for National Geographic magazine. Both of her previous books, The River of Doubt, Theodore Roosevelt's Darkest Journey, and Destiny of the Republic, about President James A. Garfield, landed on the New York Times bestseller list. Her work also appeared in Time magazine, Washington Post Book World, and the New York Times Book Review. Ms. Millard was a guest on Reader's Corner in 2012 to discuss Destiny of the Republic, and we're pleased to have her back on the show to talk about her latest book. She joins us by phone for this interview. Candace Millard, welcome back to Reader's Corner.
Hi, happy to be back.
Well, let's start with young Winston's early life. What did the British Empire look like as he was this young man flitting around the globe looking for war?
So it was absolutely enormous. It was larger than the Roman Empire at its height. The British Empire ruled over about 450,000 people. So that meant that they were constantly putting down revolts from Egypt to Ireland, and were very, very proud of what they had brought about throughout the world, and believed strongly that pretty much everybody would be better off British.
And, of course, you point out in your book that the burden the British Empire had at the time was really ruling these ever-growing colonies. How did Winston see this so-called burden?
Well, he was, as we all know, throughout his life, an unabashed imperialist. And he, too, believed that everyone would be better off British. But he saw this from a personal point of view. He saw this as an opportunity. He called war the glittering gateway to distinction. And he believed that it would be his vehicle for recognition, for fame. And then he could eventually parlay that into a political position and political power. So he wanted to be wherever these revolts were taking place. And at every opportunity, he would somehow get a military appointment. Usually he would use his mother's connections to get him there, but he would seek out the most brutal battles that the British Empire had to offer.
And where did he wind up in these various places before he got to the Boer War?
So it's really extraordinary. Think about it. He was such a young man, so he's only 24 years old when he goes to the Boer War, but this is his fourth war on three different continents. So he had already gone to Cuba in the early days of the Spanish-American War. He had fought in British India, specifically the Siege of Malacan, and he had fought in the Sudan, best known for the Battle of Omdurman, and he had been there as well.
Was he afraid in going to these wars that he might be killed? In his unquenchable thirst for war, why was he so adamant to get there on the front lines?
Well, you know, he believed in his destiny. He told his mother that he had faith in his star. But as we know, there are a lot of young men who believe that they're destined for greatness, and they die. They end up not making it out of these horrible situations. And it's really extraordinary. You know, Churchill put himself in unbelievably dangerous situations. You know, he was nearly killed many times. Once a bullet killed the horse that had been standing right next to him. He had killed men himself. He had watched his friends not just killed, but mutilated. They were, you know, sliced to ribbons by their enemies right in front of Churchill. But even so, even after horrible battle after horrible battle, he believed that he would come out all right. That and he did again and again. Not only came out with his life, but came out completely intact, which was actually pretty rare for this incredibly brutal time. But he believed that it was because he's been set aside for a greater cause.
Well, I suppose if you look at the rest of his life, if there was ever an argument for predestination, Winston Churchill proved it.
He did. You know, he believed in himself, but it was a combination, as usually is the case for these great men throughout history and great women. You know, it's a lot of determination, a lot of sacrifice, a lot of work, ingenuity, skill, intelligence, bravery, but also a large helping of luck. And that's absolutely the case with Winston Churchill.
So let's turn ourselves to the Boer War. When I think of South Africa, I think of the Afrikaners. I think of Nelson Mandela. I think of apartheid. In a sense, the Boers predate the modern South African issues and challenges that we all know about. So tell us a little bit about who they are, where they came from. I guess they weren't just Dutch. Some of them came from France.
That's right. So the Boers are the precursors to the Afrikaners. They had been living in South Africa for centuries. They were this group, sort of splinter group of largely Dutch, but also French and German immigrants. And the thing that they had in common, as well as developing their own language, Afrikaans, which was sort of Dutch, but also had some French and Portuguese and Khoikhoi in it. They were determined to be independent. They were very, very racist, and they were very independent and strong-willed, and they wanted to get away from the British Empire. So although when they first came, they established their own place to live in the Cape, they then quickly moved deep into the interior, especially in 1835, soon after the British Empire abolished slavery. They wanted to do things their own way. They wanted to get away from the British Empire. So they had what was called the Great Trek, and they moved hundreds of miles into the African interior, and they established three of their own republics, the most prominent of which was the Transvaal, and it was built around Pretoria, and that's where most of the fighting ended up happening.
Now, I assume that in that Great Trek, they ran over native populations regularly.
They did. They first, it was the Khoikhoi and the San in the Cape, and they very quickly killed thousands and thousands of them, decimated the population. But as they continued to go north, they ended up coming into contact with the Bantu people, who are largely the Zulu and the Xhosa, which would be Nelson Mandela's tribe, and they were coming south. And they proved to be much more difficult for the Boers to simply wipe out. And they fought for centuries. And the Boers learned from the Bantu people. And they became very, very good at warfare, which was something that the British didn't reckon when they were preparing for this war.
Well, that's a good point, because you described so well the difference between the way the Boers conducted war and the British with their fancy uniforms and their helmets. Tell us a little bit about that contrast.
So they called this the Khaki War. The British called this the Khaki War because it was one of the very first wars in which the British weren't wearing their dashing red coats that they had become so infamous for. So they were sort of begrudgingly putting on khakis as sort of this early nod to a change in the methods of warfare. But they hated these khaki uniforms. They bitterly complained that they made them look like bus drivers, you know, and they had to cover up their gleaming medals and their bayonets with khaki paint. But they continued to fight in these perfect, precise lines. You know, they were just spread along this very flat South African terrain, the veld, and just served up for slaughter to the Boers, who, in sharp contrast, you know, the Boers, unlike the British, they didn't have a navy. They didn't have a standing army. They weren't an empire. They didn't even wear uniforms. They just wore what they had worn every day of their lives. But they had spent generations fighting the Zulu and hunting. And so they were incredibly skilled marksmen. They had seen this war coming. And so they had been going specifically to Germany, but to Europe, gathering weapons. So in many cases, they had better weapons than the British themselves. But most of all, they could disappear. They knew this terrain inside and out, and they knew how to disappear into the veld. And so the British literally didn't see them coming. They had smokeless gunpowder. And so again and again, at the beginning of the war, the British were losing huge battle after huge battle to the Boers, and they had thought this is going to be a little colonial war. It'll last at most a couple of months, no big deal. And they were astonished to find themselves losing.
And how long did it last?
It ended up lasting almost 3 years, and it was devastating. And the British by that point were so desperate to get out of it that they resorted to just deplorable tactics. They, started the scorched earth policies where they were farm burning, and they started some of the first concentration camps. In fact, this is the first time in this war that the term concentration camp was used, because that was the Boers' support system. So the Boers could go on and on forever. They could continue to fight because they could go for food and shelter and medical care in these farms that were dotted across the veld. And the British figured that out, and so they started burning these farms and rounding up the women and children and putting them in these concentration camps. And, you know, of course, they, unlike the Nazis, the point of them was not to kill these people, but they absolutely did. They didn't have enough food. They had horrible hygiene situations. They didn't have any medical care. And so thousands and thousands of Boers died in these concentration camps.
You're listening to Reader's Corner, and I'm talking today with Candace Millard, author of Hero of the Empire, which is about the early life and exploits of Winston Churchill. So how do you describe the actual settlement of the war? Brits win, Boers lose?
Yeah, that's true. They finally did win in the end. Kitchener ended up, using this scorched earth policy to win the war, and the Boers did lose. But the British, they had promised Native Africans, look, things are going to get better for you, because the Boers treated Native Africans so terribly, and Native Africans were forced to take part in this war. In fact, there were also Native African concentration camps, and even more Native Africans died than Boers. And the British promised them that things would get better after the war, but as we know, it was a long time until we finally got to Nelson Mandela, unfortunately.
Well, it wasn't very long at all before the Boers put into law the Native Lands Act.
That's right.
Obviously, that moved a lot of non-white Africans into a very small percentage of the arable land, I think I remember reading.
That's right. And so instead of things getting better for Native Africans, they only got worse. In fact, the situation was bad for the Indian population there as well. And Gandhi had been living there for many years, developing his ideas of nonviolent resistance, trying to get the Boers to understand the importance of treating people with some respect, giving them some rights. And Gandhi finally gave up and headed back home, and the Boers were happy to see him go.
So what was it about South Africa? I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but what made the Brits so intent on wanting to take over this country? There were, I guess, some discoveries along the way.
That's right. So they've been interested in this part of the world for a long time because obviously, we're spending a lot of time in India and had to go around the Cape, and so it was a good place to stop to refuel and resupply. But then in the mid-1800s, diamonds and then gold were discovered in the Transvaal, which is one of the Boer republics. Again, that's where Pretoria is. And that was a horrible thing for the Boers, as you might imagine, because, again, what they wanted was their independence. They wanted to be left alone. And they knew that this would bring the British right down on them. In fact, Paul Kruger, who had become president of the Transvaal, predicted that this gold will cause our country to be soaked in blood. And he was right. Very soon after, in 1880, the first Boer War broke out. And that didn't last very long. And the Boers actually won that. And that was one of the reasons, I think, that the British wanted to go back and sort of defend their name and fight the war again. They never forgot that sort of shocking loss to the Boers early on.
So how does Churchill wind up in the Boer War? And obviously it's not as a soldier.
That's right. So he had left the military. It was too slow for him. He wasn't making enough progress, he thought. And so he quit and he ran for parliament and he lost. He ran before the Boer War broke out and he lost his first bid for parliament. And he realized that he had a very famous father. His father had been Chancellor of the Exchequer and leader of the House of Commons, Lord Randolph Churchill. And he felt like, I was probably, the attention I got was because of my father's name, and I need to go back and I need to make a name for myself. And he was very interested in the Boer War, but he wasn't in the military at that time. But what he was a correspondent. He had been a journalist for a long time. In fact, he had covered those three previous wars he had been in, and he was an excellent journalist. He was incredibly intrepid, always getting to the front, to the action before everybody else. And his analysis was very insightful because he had been fascinated by war from an early time. When he was a child, he had 1,500 toy soldiers, so he knew a lot about war, and he understood how it worked and had so much experience with it. But also his prose was unbelievably beautiful. As we know, he later in life wins the Nobel Prize for Literature. And so he was highly sought after when the war broke out. Many, many newspaper publishers reached out to him, and he, was very savvy about that. And he ended up going to South Africa as the highest paid correspondent England had ever had.
Wow. Now, you mentioned his father, Lord Randolph Churchill, but his mother was an American. That was an interesting relationship. You refer quite often to letters that he was sending his mother throughout his young, adventurous life.
That's right. So she was born Jenny Jerome, and she, as you say, was American. She was the daughter of a man who had sort of won and lost many fortunes. But she was incredibly beautiful, incredibly intelligent, and unbelievably charismatic. And she was sort of the sparkling center of London society and had a lot of admirers. And after her husband died, was in a lot of relationships, including rumored to have a love affair with the Prince of Wales, who became King Edward. And she had a lot of connections, and Churchill used those connections to get military appointments wherever he was. You know, he told her, this is a pushing age and we must push with the best. And although when he was young, she and her husband, Churchill's father, weren't that involved with Churchill's life. He was sent to boarding school when he was 7, begging them to come visit him, and they just never did. His father, you know, was involved with his political career. She was involved with her parties and social life. But when he became older and became interesting, she was very close to him, and he did, you know, write to her a lot and tell her, you know, his fears and his ambitions and his belief in himself.
So I guess you could say his mother's connections came to a screeching halt when he became a prisoner of war. That didn't work so well. Tell us how he becomes a prisoner of war as a journalist.
So he was on one of the first ships to South Africa after the war broke out, 3 days after the war broke out. And he was with the commander-in-chief, Sir Redvers Buller. And they get to Cape Town, and he realizes it's going to take Buller and all his supplies and men and horses way too long to get to the front. So Churchill breaks away. He quickly makes it to the front, which has been Ladysmith, but he can't get in. It's already under siege by the Boers. No one can get in or out. And so he's very frustrated. So he makes camp with a few regiments in Escort, a little town that's about 40 miles south of Ladysmith. And they're sort of trapped there. There's not much they can do. The only thing they have is an armored train that they send out for reconnaissance. But nobody wants to go on this train because it's such an easy target. You know, the Boers can watch it. They know it's on that track. They know it has to come back the same way. And so everyone fears this getting on this train. They call it a death trap. But Churchill had a good friend from his days in the military, Almer Holden, who was ordered to take the train out one day on reconnaissance. And he invites Churchill to go with him. Churchill knows how dangerous this is, but he was frustrated. He was restless. And he would later say he was eager for trouble. So on the morning of November 15th, it's raining heavily. He climbs on board this train. The Boers watch it go by. And as soon as it does, they go to the bottom of a steep hill. They pile rocks at the bottom, and then they go to the top of this hill, and they wait for the train to come back. When it does, they open fire on it, and it does just what they want it to do. It goes as fast as it can down this hill to get away from them, and it crashes into these rocks at the bottom. It catapults a couple of the cars off the tracks. It kills several men. It horribly wounds others, and it traps the rest in this sort of hailstorm of shells and bullets. And Churchill, he's 24 years old. He's not even a member of the military, but he immediately, you know, this instinct and this natural born leader, he immediately takes charge of the defense and everybody listens to him. So he's running back and forth, shouting orders, and they're able to get the engine going again and get a lot of men out alive. And these men who survive this credit Churchill for saving their lives, but Churchill is captured.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner, and my guest is Candace Millard, author of Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and The Making of Winston Churchill. You know, as I hear you describe the land, the geography, Candace, it sounds like you must have visited the land. Did you retrace some of these steps or something?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I went there in December, the same time of year that with Churchill was making his escape. So I went to where he was captured. I went to the POW camp, the building where he was kept as a POW in Pretoria. It's still the same building. It's actually a library now, a public library, but it was an officer's prison. And so these guys are highly trained cartographers. And so they drew a map of South Africa on the wall, charting the course of the war. It's still there. That map's still on the wall. There's a trap door in the floor of the room where Churchill was kept as a prisoner. And I stood in this trap door. They thought at one point about trying to tunnel their way out to freedom. I went to where he hid in a coal mine shaft with white rats for 3 days as he made his escape. I went into what's now Mozambique, was in Portuguese East Africa, where he finally came out for freedom, to the British consulate where he went. And it's, again, the same building. They even have a plaque on the wall dedicating the garden to Churchill, Churchill's garden.
Say, I was fascinated by the fact that you gave credit to the Churchill Center, and you spelled it the right way, C-E-N-T-R-E, in Chicago. I've spent most of my life in Chicago, and I must say, I didn't even know it was there, much less visit it. Tell us about that.
So it's a really amazing organization. They've just renamed themselves the International Churchill Organization, and they're fantastic. They have a great website, winstonchurchill.org, that you can go to for great articles about Churchill and facts about him, and they debunk a lot of the myths. As you can imagine, there are a lot of myths about Churchill, if you have any questions about them. But they were hugely, hugely helpful to me. The executive director read an article, an interview with me after Destiny of the Republic, where I said that I was going to write about Churchill. And he contacted me, and he opened so many doors for me, introduced me to the Churchill family, to the head of the Churchill Archives in Cambridge, to the head of the war rooms. Just again and again, they've been incredibly supportive. And it's just made it so much fun for me to, you know, this is my third book. And so I always say, I wish I had someone like him for each of my books, because, you know, making those calls on your own when people don't know who you are, and it gets a little bit easier with each book, but it's really nice to have somebody making those introductions for you.
So let's talk for a moment about Winston Churchill as a prisoner. First of all, this was a pretty big deal for the Boers to snag Churchill, I suppose.
It was a huge deal. So not only is he a son of a lord and sort of representing everything that they hate about the British, about their aristocracy and their arrogance, and they, you know, really looked down on the Boers and thought that they were sort of uneducated bumpkins, but also in particular being the son of Lord Randolph Churchill. So Randolph had been in South Africa just a few years before, not long before his death, and he had written letters back home to England that were published in newspapers excoriating the Boers, you know, for all those things that the Boers hate. You know, again, they're backward, they're uncivilized, they were, you know, dirty and uneducated, but also rightly so, because of their horrible treatment of Native Africans. And everybody in South Africa knew about those letters, and they all hated Lord Randolph Churchill. And so they were thrilled, absolutely thrilled, to have his son in their clutches.
Well, there's still a lot more left in your book, and I've got a couple of questions, but there's going to be plenty for our listeners to figure out in how he pulls all this off. But I want to jump to one thing that I thought was really amusing, and that's the fact that here this guy is, Churchill, that is, escaping from prison, spends every day of his life trying to figure out how to get out of this prison. And on the night that he does it, he takes time to write a letter. And that letter winds up making his escape even more difficult once he's out of the prison. I want you to explain that to our listeners, please.
Right. So they have this plan, and it's actually his friend's plan, and he sort of forces his way into it. They're going to jump over this 6.5-foot-tall iron paling. There's one corner of it that remains dark after the electric lights come on, and they think of the guards turn their back at just the right moment, they can get over. But only Churchill gets over, and the two men who actually planned it are trapped. The guards catch them, and they can't get over, and they don't know that Churchill's on the other side. The guards don't do it. But they had been sort of planning this and thinking about what would be the right time, and they let these men, like, order a tweed suit, and he had a hat, and he also, as you said, left a letter. He left a letter on his bed to the Boers, very, very cheeky letter, sort of thanking them for their hospitality and, you know, apologizing that he couldn't stay to thank them in person. You know, it's just really outrageous. And if you can imagine, when they find out that he's escaped, I mean, they are enraged and humiliated. And this just makes it 1,000 times worse. And they are absolutely determined to catch him. And so, for one thing, everybody, all the prisoners suffer because of Churchill, not just because of his escape, but because of his cheekiness. So all these things that they had allowed them in an attempt to look more civilized to the British, you know, letting them have newspapers, letting them draw this map on the wall, letting them even put their beds out in the hallways at night where it was cooler. All those privileges are taken away from them. And more than that, they search high and low in Pretoria. Anybody who has any English connections is under suspicion. And then they're scouring the belts looking for Churchill and are determined to catch him. And if they catch him, there's a very real risk that they will kill him.
So help us understand the route. Help us with the geography. He escapes from this prison and he has to get to Portuguese East Africa. What's that journey like? How long is it? What's involved here?
So it's almost 300 miles of enemy territory. And because he got over the fence without his friends, he doesn't have anything. They have everything. They have all the provisions. So he's trying to do this without a map, a compass. He doesn't have any food. He doesn't have a weapon. He doesn't speak the language. I mean, he's got nothing but his own audacity. And so the only thing he can think to do is to follow the railway lines. And he's finally, at night, he's able to sort of jump on the trains and then before it becomes light again, jump off. But it's incredibly difficult. And you can imagine during the day, it's blazing hot. He doesn't have any water. All he has is some chocolate in his pocket, which obviously just makes him thirstier. And then at night, it's very cold. And he's just got nothing. He's got no help. And he has very little hope. And it was really interesting to me because throughout his life, he was never a religious man. But at this point, he is so scared and so desperate that he finally stops and prays for help and guidance.
What an amazing story. And you've told it so well, Candace. I really want to thank you for joining us today. Again, the name of the book, Hero of the Empire, The Boer War, A Daring Escape, and The Making of Winston Churchill by Candace Millard. Congratulations on your best-selling books aside from this one, and good luck with this one as well.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Candace Millard. Next week, Mark Levinson, author of An Extraordinary Time, The End of the Post-War Boom and the Return of the Ordinary Economy. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.